You're listening to the Monocle Daily, first broadcast on the 20th of March 2019 on Monocle 24. Live from Midori House in London, this is the Monocle Daily. I'm Emma Nelson and a very warm welcome to today's programme, coming up in the next 60 minutes.
Now, you want us to get on with it. And that is what I am determined to do.
Theresa May digs her kitten heels in and tells everybody to back her Brexit deal or face the consequences. And she blames everybody else but herself. Also coming up, a masterclass in compassion from the New Zealand Prime Minister Jacinda Ardern. We'll examine how she set the bar for dealing with a nation in crisis. Plus, an investigation's ordered into how and why Boeing 737 MAX series was granted a licence in the light of two crashes in 5 months. Plus,
I could write way better songs.
Go ahead, but don't use A-flat or G-natural. Those notes are owned by Disney.
Oh.
That's A-flat.
Oh.
That's better.
Well, Homer, now this is owned by Disney too, as the media behemoth scoops up 21st Century Fox. That's all coming up on the Monocle Daily, live from London, starting now. And a very warm welcome to Studio One. It's Emma Nelson here with the Monocle Daily. Determined, patriotic and offering the nation what it craves. Or rather, beating people over the head with an iron bar. The British Prime Minister Theresa May addressed the nation a little over an hour ago, expressing her regret at asking the EU for a delay to Brexit. She then, in short, gave Parliament a massive telling off and blamed them for everything that's gone wrong in the last 2 years when it comes to the UK's departure from the EU. Well, listening to that speech was Joy Lodico, a columnist at the London's Evening Standard newspaper. Welcome back to the studio,
Thank
Joy.
You very much.
We will be in a moment deconstructing your highlights from a brief but rather astonishing speech. It was short. Nothing has changed in progress, has it, according to this speech, but a lot of people have got very angry.
Yes, a lot of opinions, I think, might have changed in the space of 5 minutes.
What happened?
Well, first of all, the speech was a little bit late, but what she was trying to do was say Parliament has been frustrating my will for the last 2 years, and because you don't understand the people, and I do, I'm going to go and speak to the people. And what she was trying to command was the evening news headlines, which indeed she has done through some of the quotes she gave.
But for all the wrong reasons.
But for all the wrong reasons. And she's managed to upset the very people she needs to persuade, which are a number of moderate MPs who've been told that they are not doing their jobs properly. Any members of the public who were sitting there thinking, well, maybe we should just have Theresa May's deal, have been felt completely patronised. And I imagine a number of her cabinet are also feeling rather frustrated with her having spent years trying to persuade her that her meaningful vote is going to, her deal and her meaningful vote is not going to get through.
What I couldn't quite get over, and I do really heartfelt urge people to go and watch this speech, but then have something to hide behind afterwards, is the way she delivered it. I mean, you need someone to look ministerial, like a leader, but also to make an emotional connection with your country. A little later in this programme, we're going to see how Jacinda Ardern deals with the crisis in her country. And I think she could deliver a few lessons to Mrs. May, because she sort of stropped in like a rather stern schoolmarm, gave everybody a bit of a nasty sneer, proceeded to do a telling off, and instead of waiting for a question, just sort of stormed off again. And I suddenly thought, I don't think this woman really realises how she is lacking in any method of communication with anybody. I'm not entirely sure who she was talking
to. Well, I think you've seen what happens in Cabinet. Now, the British listeners will be aware of the magazine, the satirical magazine Private Eye, which literally depicts Theresa May as a headmistress. And that is essentially her tone. But every member of her Cabinet, the opposition leaders, the leaders of all the opposition groups went in today, and they've all been receiving exactly that same treatment, saying, this is what I want to happen. Why are you not agreeing with me? And she will not listen to anybody else, which is sort of why we've got to where we've got to.
And I was looking at it thinking, well, no wonder the EU's a bit cross with her, because if you are everybody from Leo Varadkar to Emmanuel Macron to Michel Barnier, and Madam walks in and starts talking to you like that.
And Donald Tusk, who politely gave us the leeway for an extension today, in kind of measured language with some, you know, it was very subtly worded. But it was done in a sort of spirit of politeness and generosity to try and get Theresa May out of a hole. And he will have watched that speech and thought, oh, why did I even bother doing that? I mean, she's still crashing the country towards a no deal, which is not what the EU27 wants.
Well, in the true spirit of the assessment that, I don't know if anybody watches sports programmes that do a recap of a match or whatever, we've picked the highlights for everybody, just in case you miss them. And then Joy and I are going to give our reaction. Joy is going to cast her brilliant expert view on what exactly Mrs. May was or was not doing well. We've got three clips for you to hear. Let's hear the first one.
2 years on, MPs have been unable to agree on a way to implement the UK's withdrawal. As a result, we will now not leave on time with a deal on the 29th of March. This delay is a matter of great personal regret for me.
Right then. It's not her fault then.
It's not her fault. What you must remember is that MPs may have voted for it, but it was only because Gina Miller forced Theresa May, who at that point was using it as an executive power, intervened and created a legal case that forced her to actually take it to Parliament. And Parliament, almost in deference to the fact she'd actually brought it to them, voted through Article 50, assuming she had a plan. Over the last 2 years, they have watched that plan, which has not been going well for a long time, and have keep saying, no, 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 try this. And she says, no, I won't do it. And so suddenly the failure is theirs, not hers. Now, that is one of the kind of main causes of anger at this point in time amongst the parliamentarians who represent their constituents and who represent a whole range of views within those constituencies, from Remainers to Leavers to people in the middle. And they've can find no response from Theresa May when they keep pointing this out.
She has got a slight point insofar as they have told her everything that they don't want, but Parliament is so divided that it is now incapable of deciding a positive and constructive way forward. But would you agree that that would be the best way of dealing with it?
I'm going to contradict you on that. Parliament keeps asking, this is led by Dominic Grieve, for indicative votes, which are votes for what they are in favour of, and that might be Norway Plus, it might be Common Market 2.0, sorry if everybody's lost on the terminology here.
You have the internet and later.
Yeah, for a people's vote. And Theresa May keeps blocking them on doing those things. And if you sit down and say, well, who said what we don't want? The first person who said what we don't want was Theresa May when she laid down a series of red lines that have proved almost impossible to get over, which is we don't want to be in the single market. We don't want to have any form of open borders. We don't want to be in a customs union. And she has been trying to position to create a deal from within those red lines for 2 years. So she was the first person who created the negative space. And since then, what Parliament has done is rather sensibly voted down no deal, which nobody wants, apart from if you are in a kind of rather weird fringe kind of right-wing WTO cult. They voted down her deal. Now she won't let any other options go on the table. So I'm afraid I think that's, I feel, you know, I want to be generous to Theresa May, but that is completely disingenuous.
Okay, well, let's have a little listen about what she thinks Parliament has done wrong in a little bit more detail.
So far, Parliament has done everything possible to avoid making a choice. Motion after motion and amendment after amendment has been tabled without Parliament ever deciding what it wants. All MPs have been willing to say is what they do not want.
Now, here's in a moment where she's telling everybody that, as we've just said, everyone's been telling us what we don't want. Mm. But people are now saying, well, you're running down the clock. She's accusing people of making, you know, a sort of delaying things and pushing things into the long grass, but arguably that's not how other people might see it.
No, look, if you go, you know, deep into the history of the Brexit referendum, the Leave campaigners were campaigning for parliamentary sovereignty. Over and over again, they wanted Parliament to be able to make its own decisions. Here is Parliament intervening on a regular basis on what is being put before them by the executive. And the legislature has historically, and you know, we are, England is the mother of all parliaments. We have refined laws over time. We've refined bills over time in order to make them workable. And she will not let that happen. So those motions and amendments are part of our democratic process. I find it rather worrying that she thinks that is frustrating her will. I would say that was moving towards a sort of autocracy outlook rather than one of democracy.
Finally, let's have a listen to what she thinks the British public want.
Some have suggested holding a second referendum. I don't believe that's what you want, and it is not what I want. We asked you the question already, and you gave us your answer. Now you want us to get on with it. And that is what I am determined to do.
Now, did you feel slightly patronised by that?
I felt slightly patronised by that. I think about 60% of the British population feel slightly patronised by that. If you go and take a poll at the moment, around 30% want to literally just go off a cliff edge and go on WTO rules or just leave or whatever has to happen, do the deal, whatever. About 10% actually actively support Theresa May's deal. And about 60%, or pushing up towards 60%, now want us to have a second referendum. So the people of 2016 is rather different from the people today. And if she thinks, if she's talking to one set of people, she's going to meet a lot of another set of people on Saturday when there is a second referendum march, which numbers are expected to be a million or so, which would make it possibly the largest march in British history.
I don't think that's going to make any difference to Theresa May. And you and I both know that I'm probably going to be at the starting line for this march on Saturday. But what I found astonishing there is that she was basically saying, back me, Britain, because you're fed up, you're bored of this, and this is the only way out. Now, I don't necessarily feel very inspired by that line of argument.
So what she also said is this country doesn't want European elections. So what she's saying over and over again, and she says also ruled out a general election. I remind you again, it is her who's ruling things out here. What she's basically ruled out is three forms of democracy to the British public. And this is where, I mean, we may be frustrated by that speech, but I would say we should start getting seriously worried, because although we vote in a government every 4 or 5 years, we didn't vote in Theresa May's government with any sort of majority when she did come in. And since then, everything is moving against it. And she's desperately clinging on to power now and refusing to let us vote on things.
You mentioned the Conservative MP a moment ago, Dominic Grieve, who is a very big supporter of a second referendum. And he was commenting on the fact that she said that Theresa May said that a second referendum would cause irrevocable damage to public trust. Now, Dominic Grieve has said he won't be bullied into this, and neither will the Houses of Parliament, especially given what she's just said tonight. He gave us three options, though, that's likely to happen in the next few weeks. A, the United Kingdom crashes out on March the 29th in a complete mess. B, Article 50 is revoked, and then it has to be resubmitted. Or C, a referendum is held. Mm. As we stand following that speech in the United Kingdom today, what's your money on?
That's a terrible question, because it depends on the level of chaos next week. There is a small problem. I'm sorry, this is a real technicality. But because Theresa May insisted on putting March the 29th into our own legislation as the leaving date, that has to be taken out, and that process has to start on Monday. Now, she's not going to have had her final vote on Monday, so it may be that, in fact, we find ourselves careering out of the EU with no deal because of a piece of legislation that hasn't got through Parliament because everything else is log-jammed. So I am increasingly worried that's the way we're going to go. And I think the only person who can save us now is the Speaker, John Bercow.
With his jumper.
Well, yeah, with his great jumper.
Joy Ladiko, thanks for joining us and filling us with doom. The time is 22:13 here in London. You're listening to The Monocle Daily. And you're listening to The Monocle Daily live from Studio One at Midori House in London. There is a playbook that most well-trained national leaders follow in times of crisis. First and foremost, show you care, then take action and reassure your people. It's a method that has been adopted all too rarely in recent history. Look at Donald Trump after pretty much every public tragedy, or indeed Theresa May failing to visit the victims of the Grenfell fire in its immediate aftermath. The New Zealand Prime Minister, however, Jacinda Ardern, has not only followed the script in recent days, she seems to have rewritten the rule book. And Lloyd Burr is the Europe correspondent for News Hub, and he's been following the events following the shootings in Christchurch last Friday and the quite breathtaking way in which Jacinda Ardern arguably has stepped up.
Absolutely. She is holding a wounded country together. This is an unprecedented attack in New Zealand, and in times like this, when we're all devastated and lost and have no idea how to explain what's happened, we really need a leader who can lead, and a leader who can lead with empathy and understanding and make big calls. And Jacinda Ardern has done that. No matter what political affiliation you have, no matter if you support the Tories in New Zealand or whatever, a lot of people who are Tory supporters look to Jacinda Ardern and are really proud of the way that she has led the country through this. So she's done a really good job, and the way she's done it is because she has been empathetic. You can't fake that. You can't fake the love, kindness and empathy that she has brought to Christchurch in the wake of this horrific massacre.
I think the thing that really struck me in the first instant was the fact that she immediately on social media said that the person who carried out this has no place in our country, and whoever was affected by this was a New Zealander, regardless of to where you have come from or where, and who or what you choose to worship. But the next day, I don't think I've ever seen a world leader embrace members of the public in the way that Jacinda Ardern did. You saw her going and holding a woman, a mourning woman, close to her and hugging and hugging and hugging. And it made me realise just how distant our leaders have now become.
Yeah, I guess that's not unusual for me, because Jacinda Ardern has always been a hugger. When she came over to the UK and recently, it was about a month ago, and it was the first time I've seen her for about a year, and I gave her a hug. And that's just what you do. I mean, yes, I'm a journalist, and yes, I can grill her and question her and stuff like that, but she is a hugger, and that's who she is. Now, Theresa May, I could never imagine getting a hug from Theresa May or the former Prime Minister Bill English or John Key, but I guess it's just in her makeup. That's just who she is as a person, and she wears that on her sleeve. She doesn't have behind-the-scenes Jacinda and in public Jacinda. She is the person you see on the telly and in these pictures, and these incredible pictures of her wearing a hijab and hugging people. And that's just who she is. She's just. There's no rule book for this at all. She's just following her heart.
Combined, though, with that amazing empathy that you've just described, although I am still trying to come to terms with the idea of a national leader giving people hugs, hugging can sometimes appear to be either patronising or full of pity, but this is married to a steely love and fierce protection of her country and a clear sense of what needs to be done.
Yeah, and she has defined herself as wanting to be a kind government, because she's a kind person. So she's everything she does, the budget, policies, everything has to be done with being kind in mind. And so I think you can't really fake a hug. And if you did, you'd see straight through it. And she's just gone in there and she's just done what she needs to do. And those people wanted a hug. And I think today she was at a high school and she was hugging the kids. Hugging the kids who are looking at what's happening in their backyard, it makes me quite proud actually as a New Zealander, because I'm so used to being a political journalist and having to follow these politicians around and see them as doing what politicians do, campaigning and always being careful about every single thing you do and that type of stuff. But as a New Zealander watching from afar, and having worked with Jacinda Ardern for sort of 7 years, it's made me quite proud, actually.
Her proactive nature as well, in terms of a commitment to changing the gun laws. I mean, immediately everybody just looked straight to Donald Trump and said, if only you could do one-tenth of what this woman seems to have done. But I think a lot of people have quite admired the fact that whatever she has to do in terms of changing the gun laws has to be done quickly, because you cannot hold back on this kind of thing. However, she and all her cabinet were putting a sort of, we don't know quite what we're doing, just give us time, let us think this through. There was an emphasis on intelligent government here, which I think, given the fact that our world now lives at 100 miles an hour, is quite a brave step to make.
Yep, she said, I think gun laws will change, was her exact quote. And she will announce them in about 4 days. She's already had a cabinet meeting, and the agenda on that cabinet meeting was banning automatic, semi-automatic and pistols from New Zealand, unless you get some super amazing license. So she's going to roll out these reforms within a couple of days. And I think that's since the date of the massacre. massacre, the shooting, the terror attack, it's 10 days. And so she made that decisive action. And another thing that blows my mind about what she did was when Donald Trump rang her and, you know, said, "My thoughts and prayers are with you, is there anything I can do?" She said, "Give your love and kindness to Muslim communities." She actually said that to Donald Trump, knowing that, you know, he's anti-immigration and he's put this Muslim majority country ban in place. So she really is just taking the bull by the horns and being empathetic and doing what no other leader would sort of dare to do. The other leaders are so calculated in these responses to disasters like this. And what blows me away is that she is just taking the bull by the horns and she is protecting New Zealand, uniting New Zealand, and it's really important at this time.
Lloyd Burr, thank you very much indeed for joining us on Monocle 24. You're listening to the Monocle Daily. Up next, as C-SPAN turns 40, we asked, has it turned politics into a TV spectacle? Stay with us.
The Golden Age of Aviation is a brand new series on Monocle 24, chronicling and celebrating all that was great about commercial airline travel during the 1950s, 60s and 70s. We'll be meeting pilots, designers, cabin crew, engineers and even pop stars to tell you stories about engineering innovators, fearless individuals in boardrooms and cockpits, and the big brands that defined a new era of travel.
You know, that's what it is for me. It's this feeling of optimism and possibilities and just sort of reaching out to the world, being able to shrink the world, bring people together.
Download The Golden Age of Aviation in association with Breitling every other Thursday.
Welcome back to the Monocle Daily. If you've just joined us, the time is 22:21 here in London. It's Emma Nelson here, and a little later on we'll find out how the Writers Guild is taking on Hollywood's agents and trying to win. But first, it is 40 years since television cameras were first allowed into follow proceedings in the US House of Representatives. It was a huge step. It opened up American politics to the outside world, and it acted as inspiration to several other nations, including the United Kingdom, to follow suit. This is what the first day sounded like.
On this historic day, the House of Representatives opens its proceedings for the first time to televised coverage.
That was C-SPAN's first broadcast from the U.S. House of Representatives chamber on March the 19th, 1979. The voice was Al Gore's when he was a representative from Tennessee. Well, to tell us more, I'm joined by Pema Levy, who's a reporter at Mother Jones in Washington, D.C. Pema, a very warm welcome back to the programme. What was the first broadcast like?
Oh, gosh. I don't know exactly. I mean, I have to say, like, people, it wasn't that no one had ever seen, the inside of Congress before. Americans had been tuning in for various things, you know, all the way back to the 1950s. My mother remembers as a child watching the McCarthy hearings on television all day long. So I think that, you know, when there was some sort of big display, Americans already were able to tune in. I think what changed with C-SPAN is that it really chronicled things that were more mundane, but also meant that you could really see the details and the minutiae. And it meant that things that, you know, might have slipped people by and not become a big thing, all of a sudden that was accessible, not just to the public, but also to journalists who, you know, can't be in every room at once, but can go back and look at the footage and look at what's been going on and gain that perspective of being able to see it firsthand.
And as a result, how did the reporting and indeed the perception of what went on in the House of Representatives change?
You know, I think it's changed. I think it's a democratizing thing, actually, you know, because it opens things up in the same way that, you know, technology tends to do that. You know, there are certainly pluses and minuses to each new technology that comes along. But the more access you give to something, the more ability you have for reporters and people in the public to take note of it and to see it. And the more eyes are watching. And so I think that lawmakers certainly had to become aware of that and to adjust to the fact that the cameras were always rolling. And also, you know, as I said, it gave people an ability to see things and pick up on things that might have gone unnoticed before, because it was there documented. And certainly, you know, video is a very powerful medium. it's one thing to have a transcript of proceedings. It's another thing to be able to watch it. And then, you know, certainly in the era of the internet, you know, make your own video of that and then share it and have it, you know, go viral or and have people sort of experience it for themselves.
Well, all too keenly are we here in the United Kingdom feeling the effect of live televised debate within the Houses of Parliament. We're watching as various factions within various parties are grandstanding in so many ways, in the full knowledge that if they say something and it's interesting enough, the likelihood is it's going to be reported. It has led to accusations that to openly televise something like parliamentary proceedings, which can be dry as heck, can actually turn into something which is unreal and hyperreal.
You know, I think that there's like a small element of that here in the United States with something like C-SPAN. You know, certainly someone, you know, might be wanting to make a splash. They might be going in search of headlines. And so they can make a dramatic speech. You know, they can give the media a heads up in advance that they want to watch, for example. And so certainly I think that there will be some grandstanding. And I think, you know, in a heated debate, for example, there might also be more of an incentive to sort of go all out in your rhetoric, for example, or, you know, become more heated or angry. But, you know, a lot of things still take place behind closed doors. You know, at least in the United States, there are all sorts of, you know, closed door meetings and negotiations and phone calls that are going on that are not broadcast on live TV. And so I think, you know, that element of politics certainly remains. And the grandstanding aspect of it, I think, is ultimately pretty minimal.
Then we take it to the next level, though, that, yes, people grandstand, but we've become used to it. But then the United States gets itself a president who decides to sort of almost run his own broadcasting service via the internet. Indeed, we have a television reality star in the White House. Is it too outlandish a suggestion to say that if you televise it, you're actually going to get TV personalities who drive the agenda?
Yeah, I don't quite see it that way. But I do think certainly you're right to point out the fact that there is a president in the White House who literally had his own reality TV show and certainly knows how to work the media, knows how to get the media's attention, knows how to, you know, drive that coverage, make themselves the only news story day after day after day. But I don't think that that media savvy comes from actually anything like C-SPAN. I think that comes from the network television. And I think it's very different. C-SPAN's business model is not to only air, you know, the things that give them the most ratings, the things that are the most sensational. They are sort of the only sort of neutral platform left here that simply shows you, you know, the debates day after day. I think what Trump is an outgrowth of the parallel media universe, parallel TV of networks in which, you know, they're for-profit companies driven by their ratings. If you know how to make news, you know how to say outlandish things and get those eyeballs on you, then you're going to get more coverage. And that's sort of a working the refs savvy that I think certainly Trump used to his advantage during the campaign and continues to as president. And, you know, certainly C-SPAN is not the only station that covers Congress. I mean, they're the ones that are there every single day with their cameras. But, you know, when there's big news to happen, when there are big hearings, you know, the other television stations are there as well to be covering it. So I actually think that C-SPAN, if anything, is sort of the duller, more neutral cousin to what we have going on, you know, CNN, on Fox, on MSNBC, and on the other networks as well.
Oh, poor C-SPAN, the way you described it. But actually, it chimes with an American friend I was talking to earlier on today. I said, what's the influence of C-SPAN? And he just went, no one watches it outside the Beltway, meaning the ring road outside Washington. Is that really C-SPAN's place nowadays?
I think that that is untrue, and I think that that you can tell that because of the people who call in. C-SPAN will have, you know, these sort of they really do almost feel like they come from a different era, because they're very subdued, and they'll have some figure from the media on to answer questions from readers or from viewers, for example. You know, but the viewers who are calling in are not just from Washington. They're from all over the country. You know, so certainly it is something that a certain number of people, much fewer than I imagine watch CNN or Fox, are watching and calling into, probably because it does offer that more mellow view of politics. But as I mentioned before, it is an extremely useful resource to people in the Beltway, to people who are covering politics all the time. You know, as I said, you can't be in every hearing all the time absorbing everything, but it is incredibly useful to be able to go back and watch a hearing, you know, or if you want to understand a certain candidate, go, you know, or a certain politician, go back and watch multiple hearings, go back and watch multiple floor speeches. So it provides a resource, certainly, that I imagine folks here in Washington do avail themselves of more than folks outside of it.
Pema Levy, thank you very much indeed for joining us on Monocle 24. You with the Monocle Daily with me, Emma Nelson. And in a moment, we find out why the Writers Guild is taking on Hollywood's agents. But first, with the time 22:30 here in London, let's get a summary of the latest world news headlines. The UK's Prime Minister Theresa May has written to the European Union to ask for a 3-month delay to Brexit. The UK is set to leave the bloc at the end of next week, but Mrs. May now wants that to be postponed until June. Her letter says she needs more time to get her withdrawal deal passed and ratified by the UK Parliament. A UN court has rejected an appeal by the former Bosnian Serb leader Radovan Karadzic and increased his sentence to life in prison. Karadzic was originally found guilty of genocide and war crimes in 2016 and given a 40-year prison sentence, but the tribunal at The Hague has now ruled that that was too lenient. And people in the Netherlands have been voting in the country's provincial elections. It's thought that populist parties could make gains following a suspected terror attack in the city of Utrecht earlier this week. Pro-election polls have indicated that Mark Rutte's centre-right coalition is expected to lose its majority in the Senate. This is the Monocle Daily. The battle lines are constantly being drawn and redrawn in Hollywood. Who should take credit for this? Who should claim responsibility for that? And who should be paid for what? Well, in the brave new world where traditional production methods have been overtaken by new firms and fresh outlets, we are indeed in new territory and not everybody likes it, because a row has broken out between the Writers Guild of America and the Association of Talent Agents, and there are no signs of it being resolved. Well, I'm joined down the line by Jonathan Handel, who's a contributing editor at The Hollywood Reporter. Welcome, Jonathan. You've written about this row. Tell us what's happened.
Well, it's a pleasure to be with you. And it's about power and money. The agents, who've been around, of course, for many, many decades, are regulated by the Writers Guild. And the Writers Guild wants to dial their power back. The agencies, the talent agencies, are very powerful players. The Guild wants to prohibit two practices. One is the way the agencies get paid. Those who think about agents may think they get paid 10% of the writer's salary or the actor's salary, what have you. But actually, more commonly, especially in television, they get paid by the studio, and they don't get paid, and they don't take a commission at all from the actor or the writer. The Writers Guild says, well, it's nice to save that 10%, but that disincentivizes the agents, they claim, from pushing for higher wages for the talent. One of the talent agencies just released a study today that attempts to refute that with data. The second practice is that the agencies are actually getting into the production business themselves, setting up affiliates that act like mini studios. And this is sort of a symbol of the degree to which the major studios actually distribute movies but don't put them together. So it's a bit of inside the weeds, but what happens is starting April 7th, when the existing contract expires, if they don't reach a deal, and it looks like they won't, the Writers Guild will probably tell its members to fire their agents en masse.
And is that likely to happen?
Well, that's something I've talked to the presidents of multiple agencies, and I've talked to writers, and there's entertainment lawyers, and on, and everyone is asking themselves that same question and in that same shocked tone of voice. There is no predicting what's going to happen, except one thing. probably a lot of litigation if they don't reach a deal.
So the lawyers ultimately win in all this. But tell us a little bit about, generally speaking, when you have an argument, there is a public opinion which sways sort of in the favor of one side. Where are we with this one?
Well, the Writers Guild has been doing a very good job of getting its members concerned about this issue, and there's been a big public relations brouhaha. I'd say that the writers are probably winning the public relations battle, but the agencies can outspend them in litigation if it does come to that. So it's one of those complicated things. The facts here are not always as simple as a simple headline. My agent did this. My agent did that. There certainly have been many abuses on the part of talent agencies over the decades, including involving the practices that I alluded to. But whether knocking that all down is the right thing is a big question, because if these agencies aren't taken down a peg and are less powerful, who is going to stand up to Disney, which is now huge, just acquired Fox? Who's going to stand up to Netflix? Who's going to stand up to Warner Brothers? Warner Media is now owned by the telephone company AT&T. Universal Studios, owned by the cable company Comcast. These companies are getting bigger and bigger and bigger. And the agencies say the only way to fight that on behalf of individual talent is for the agencies to be powerful.
Which arguably suggests that in actual fact that the writers and the talent agents should in fact get together on this instead of fighting.
Well, it's very difficult because of that. That's right. The agencies and the guild, which is the union that represents the writers, share an overlapping constituency. They both represent writers. And the agencies have found this a difficult public relations battle to fight, in fact, because they don't want to be seen in the position of fighting their own clients, some of whom are the leadership of this union, of the Writers Guild. But the agencies do feel that the Writers Guild is playing fast and loose with some of the facts. The Writers Guild feels that the agencies have built huge buildings and huge businesses and huge fortunes on the backs of individual labor, and that should be recalibrated. And it's all a very tough nut.
Tell us a little bit about how people who either work in the industry or indeed who watch things, which I'd imagine would be quite a few, are going to see any change in the production of television and film.
Well, that's an open question. One of the things the agents do is put together shows. That's the packaging process. And if the agents don't do it, someone's going to have to step into the breach. Otherwise, the 500 or so shows that we have on the air, scripted shows, that's leaving aside competition, reality, are going to dwindle somewhat, are going to be affected by that. So when and whether the typical viewer is going to see a difference, hard to know. We're in the process, we'll be shortly in April, in the process of the staffing season, where writers get hired to write the network dramas, ABC, CBS, NBC, and Fox. And that's going to be disrupted if there isn't a deal here. The Writers Guild says, we'll just set up a bulletin board, an electronic bulletin board online, and people can submit for those slots. The agents and everyone else in the industry is looking at that with some disbelief.
Jonathan Handel, thank you very much indeed for joining us on the program. And a little later, you may have heard Jonathan mentioning there the takeover of Disney, the takeover of Fox by Disney. Well, we'll be finding out more about that later on the Monocle Daily. Boeing is to undergo a review of the way its 737 MAX series was granted a license to fly. It follows two crashes in 5 months in which it's being claimed there was a very similar pattern of events. Well, Gabriel Lee is Monocle's transport correspondent and he joins us now. Gabriel, this order has come from the United States authorities, hasn't it?
That's right. So the U.S. Department of Transportation has now ordered a review into what happened in terms of the certification of the 737 MAX, looking at, the FAA's process as well as, what Boeing was doing through that process as well.
Tell us a little bit more about what's brought around this, the licensing question itself. The circumstances of the crash of the Ethiopian Airlines and of the Lion Air, people are saying that there was a fault with the way that the 737 MAX 8's ability either to take off or indeed the direction of its nose cone was facing were both showing similar signs of faults. How easy is that to pick up when you're checking a new aircraft for its safety?
Well, I mean, it's really hard to speculate because there's so much that goes into certification. And what seems to be evident is that the FAA didn't particularly think that this system that we now think is at fault in these two crashes. Again, we don't know for sure. But this new system, basically software that Boeing put in order to keep the plane's nose up in certain situations, it seems that the FAA thought that this was not particularly a critical addition. They didn't even brief their high-level people about it. They didn't look into it too deeply. But now we know that it seems that this can be triggered to disastrous effect when there's a single point of failure, which is to say one sensor that says the nose is pitching up higher than it is. And that is kind of unheard of to allow something like that onto a commercial aircraft in this day and age.
Indeed, it's called a maneuvering characteristics augmentation system that makes sure that the plane's nose tilts down when it feels as if the plane is just about to stall, insofar as it's going to stop the plane from stalling. How common a feature is that in aircraft like the Boeing 737 MAX series? Or was this a new idea that had been built into this new generation of aircraft?
Well, you know, there's a lot of technology going into airplanes these days that help it to fly and not fly outside of what they call its flight envelope. So they're not going to, especially Airbus, you know, they don't allow the plane to roll too far over or do things that would cause it to stall. But this was kind of a new thing where there was this kind of small addition just to make sure that the nose wouldn't pitch up too much. And that was because of the way they had to design the new engines on this plane. It changed the aerodynamics a little bit. They found that it would actually tend towards pitching the nose up, and just in order to be kind of just safe about it, I think the way they approached it was, you know, just to make sure we'll have this thing running in the background so that, you know, something happens unexpected, the nose goes up a little bit too much, this thing will just kind of gently lower it down. And it seems that actually in practice it hasn't worked out like that at all.
Is there any indication that when the licensing was being granted and the processes were being done to make sure that this plane was airworthy, that something could have been missed?
You know, it's hard to say because we still don't have all the information out of either of these two crashes, and especially about the Ethiopian one. But it does seem to be that this was unusual, that this system would have been so easily allowed to be put into the aircraft without further scrutiny, and also without putting it more in under the spotlight for pilots, for airlines to know about it. So the sense, I think, is that yes, that. I don't know if it was something that was missed or something that was underestimated. The very strange part of it is that single point of failure. The fact that it runs off of one sensor that tells the angle of attack, the nose, the angle that the nose is at on the aircraft. The fact that it can rely on just one of those being wrong or being unusual to be triggered. That's the part that I really don't understand, how the FAA or even Boeing, for that matter, could have said, well, this is fine.
Was there any indication that when you have a company as big as Boeing, it is almost assumed that what they are trying to have licensed is going to be perfectly airworthy?
Well, I think, you know, Boeing has a really great long history of safe aircraft that have only gotten safer. I think everyone probably expects that they wouldn't do anything to, you know, make a product that would, you know, suddenly crash out of nowhere, that they would be the ones that would be most careful about this kind of thing. You know, the situation with how they came to design the 737 MAX, how they kind of had to rush into that to compete with Airbus, that raises questions about maybe did they go too fast? Maybe was this a sort of design patch that was ill-conceived? Up until this point, I think we've had this sort of increasingly relaxed sense about air safety because it's gotten so safe and because, you know, we assume that Boeing and the FAA are really on top of these things. So, you know, it's something that maybe causes us to look again a little more closely, and I think it's a good thing that, you know, another department of the U.S. government is, you know, scrutinizing this and looking at this process. I think we'll learn from it, if nothing else.
What about the future of the way that the FAF grants its licensing? Can we trust it to be as impartial and as thorough as we would hope it to be?
Yeah, I mean, that's the big question right now. And it's said that, you know, recently the FAA has been using modified rules to allow, in effect, Boeing to have more authority over how They would, you know, determine if things were safe, almost kind of outsourcing the process to the manufacturer itself, which is, you know, something that would raise a red flag, of course. But I think, again, if nothing else, this situation, this process will definitely lead to some, you know, introspection at the FAA and, you know, looking at their processes and what may have gone wrong if something did.
Gabriel Leith, many thanks for joining us on Monocle 24. The time is 6:44 in Beijing, 22:44 in London. Let's have a check of the Asian front pages, and I'm delighted to say that Clarissa Sebag Montefiore, who's Monocle's Sydney correspondent, joins us on the line from there now. Welcome back to Monocle 24, Clarissa. Let's begin with allegations by a woman, a football player, who said that she feels sexually abused by comments on social media.
Yes, so this is a woman, AFL star called Taylor Harris, who had an amazing photograph taken of her mid-match, her legs raised in mid-kick. But the photograph, when it was put up online by a sports photographer, was bombarded with misogynistic comments to the point where Harris has called it, quote, sexual abuse on social media.
To what degree is what is it that's actually that's triggered her reaction so strongly?
Well, part of the issue is that the Seven Network put up a picture of the post, was bombarded, like I said, with horrific comments, often very sexually explicit comments about this footy star, and they removed the post. And then they went under fire from Taylor Harris herself, from sports commentators, from media personalities, and just from general people on the internet, saying they sent the wrong message. They were giving in to trolls by removing the post. So they've apologized and put back up the post saying, we're sorry, we sent out the wrong message. But I think it triggers broader issues, which is that women's football is just celebrated here. It's not covered at all, really, on mainstream media, not nearly as much as male sports, at least. And the Women's Football League, the AFL League, was only launched in 2017. So this is all quite new as well.
The difficulty is that once a picture like that is put out there, it is, and the horrible comments start, it is impossible to try and rein it in, no matter what you say and no matter who you try and complain to.
Exactly. And so I think she has said, I don't want to give oxygen to the trolls, but I'd really just prefer it to be up and to celebrate female football. I mean, it's a wonderful picture of athleticism. It's not a sexually explicit picture. It's a picture of her kicking a football. And I think she said, and other people have noticed, that perhaps this has a comment on Australia, which can still be a misogynistic culture, has really big problems with domestic violence. And like any culture, things like rape are underreported. And not prosecuted perhaps the way they should be. So this is raising bigger issues about trolls who have these opinions about women.
Right, let's move on to the Guardian coverage in Australia of the extinction of mammals. Australia has the highest rate of mammal extinction in the world, but the Environment Department doesn't seem to know what to do about it.
Yes, this is definitely a problem. Australia is obviously a country with a lot of mammals, but they don't seem to have tracked who's going extinct when, and that is definitely an issue.
And let's move on to something that the Morrison government is doing, and that's a shake-up to Australia's migration program. What's this all about?
So data shows that the Australian economy is only growing because of population growth, but that comes at a cost, which is a huge pressure on major cities' infrastructure, such as Sydney and Melbourne. So Prime Minister Scott Morrison has said that skilled visas and family visas will be reduced from 190,000 a year to 160,000 a year. That's not such a big deal because over 160,000 people settled through this visa migration program last year anyway. But what is new is that he said that regional visas for skilled workers, he'll be setting up a new regional visa for skilled workers, which will go through a permanent residency program if they live in rural areas. And through this, he's hoping to fill just under 50,000 job vacancies in rural areas because most people want to come to the big coastal cities when they move to Australia.
The difficulty that we have now is that the spotlight is quite tragically altering insofar as the person who is alleged to have carried out all the shootings in Christchurch is an Australian national. And we have more than once on Monocle 24 talked about the issue of the far right and extreme views becoming more acceptable, becoming more mainstream, sometimes pushed by the Prime Minister himself. How much has what happened in Christchurch changed the way that people report issues like immigration?
Well, he's come under criticism from the opposition leader, Bill Shorten, who's saying he's political dog whistling in light of Christchurch. He's basically drumming up anti-immigration votes. There will be a federal election later this year, and he's criticised Scott Morrison by saying you're just trying to get the popular vote by saying let's keep out foreigners through a migration policy. And also Bill Shorten's also pointed out that it doesn't solve the issues of students and tourists who really make up the biggest foreign influx into Australia and contribute hugely to congestion issues in the big cities, which is where they're really, really travelling to visit, places like Sydney, places like Melbourne. So I think the media has taken hold of that as well and asked, is this a fair policy or not?
Indeed, it's quite an unusual and frankly baffling approach to take. If you hear a nation's prime minister saying we need to cut immigration, and someone says why, it's not often you hear the argument, which is being quoted all over the Australian news, is about not just managing population growth, but it's about investments, as you said, congestion busting on the roads, as well as social cohesion. I mean, how have people taken to the idea that if you have fewer migrants, you'll be able to get to work on time? I mean, it's astonishing.
Yeah, it doesn't seem to be going to the root issue, which is that Melbourne's a bit better, but particularly Sydney has a terrible, terrible public transport issues. They ripped up all the trams in the 1960s, every single last tram, which was frankly a tragedy for the city. And because of that, it became a car city, not quite as bad as LA, but almost on that level. And that seems to be the core issue. Really, they need to invest in good public transport, which is something they're trying to do, but takes a long time. They've had a lot of scandals regarding it. And so I think a lot of people feel it's less to do with migration and more to do with top-down investment in infrastructure.
Finally, we have had so much terrible coverage of what happened in Christchurch, but there have been tributes paid to at least one teenager who's sort of stood up to a senator about it.
Yes, so he has been known internationally as Egg Boy. So essentially, a far-right senator called Fraser Anning blamed the Christchurch massacre on Muslim immigration. He's an Australian far-right senator. He said, quote, "The real cause of bloodshed on New Zealand streets today is the immigration program." When he was giving a talk, a teenager threw an egg at him, and Fraser Anning punched the teenager, and it was all filmed online. It went viral, and Egg Boy, as he's become known, has become a sort of international hero, to the point where NBA All-Star player Ben Simmons pay tribute to him by writing Egg Boy on his yellow sneakers yesterday.
Clarissa Sebag Montefiore, thank you very much indeed for joining us on Monocle 24. You're listening to the Monocle Daily. Up next, a huge investment for Disney. Stay with us.
When it comes to making friends and influencing others, smart nations know they need to show off their softer side. Join the Conga Line in our annual Soft Power Survey to find out where your nation stands. Playing now in the film section at monocle.com.
Finally, after months of negotiations, Disney has formally agreed to buy 21st Century Fox. Disney says it wants to increase, and I'm quoting, its international footprint. Well, to find out what that quite means for Disney and indeed for the rest of us, I'm joined by Mark Edelman, who's a consultant and media strategist. He joins us on the line from Monocle's LA Bureau. A very warm welcome to the programme, Mark. Everybody has been agog at the size of this deal, haven't they?
It's a mind-numbing number. I think almost $72 billion. It's a lot of Mickey Mouse, right?
That's an awful lot of Mickey Mouse. Who's bought what, and what does it mean?
Well, I think if you take a step back, it's really sort of like the nuclear arms deal of content. And we're sort of living in a world right now where, I guess if we had to look at sort of the Cold War, it's an arms race. And what Disney just acquired is a lot of content and a lot of avenues now to reach even more people than they were reaching before. And you can't really look at what just happened with the Fox and Disney acquisition and not look at how Netflix continues to literally and metaphorically change the game the way the city is working.
I mean, this is astonishing. I mean, Disney is adding the Fox Film and TV Studio, the FX Networks, National Geographic, Indian TV giant Star India, Fox's 30% stake in streaming services Hulu, and then Hulu takes Disney's stake in other things, and off we go. I mean, is there any slice of the broadcasting pie that Disney now does not have an investment in?
No. I mean, I think, you know, and you forget also they own ESPN, you know, which is the last 20 years one of their biggest revenue drivers, which is now changing a little bit. But that's sports here, now, there, and everywhere. You look at what Discovery is doing in Europe right now with also acquiring sports channels, you know, exponentially. So these media companies are platforms in every sense of the word now. They can reach you in any way they want to. And I think that's both very exciting, and it's going to be interesting to see what that actually looks like pragmatically as we go forward.
Well, indeed. I mean, shareholders have said yes. The United States Department of Justice said yes. European regulators, Chinese regulators, nobody seems to have stood in the way of this deal in the main. But if you were someone who was worried about the independence of content and the independence of people's voices in broadcasting, what would you think?
Well, look, I think this has been a critique that's gone back decades now, and I think it's a very salient point. All these media entities are owned by corporate conglomerations at this point. And you look at all of the studios, we went from 6 to 5 as of midnight tonight, or last night, I should say. There are a lot of other voices that will get in the way, I think, of what people view as sort of pure art and the ability to exercise their artistic interests. And, you know, you look at what's interesting, like part of what Disney acquired was Fox Searchlight, which, you know, produced the film The Favorite. And as you know, Olivia Colman won the Oscar for that. And so I do want to point out that there are still a lot of avenues for content to be made that I think don't feel like these big blockbuster films that people sort of tend to not like and feel like there is a siphoning of that type of creativity. And I would also point out that if you're a content maker right now, it's all about content. There are so many distributed channels that you can get on right now that you couldn't 5 years ago. And so I do think that's very exciting. Just today, Mindy Kaling announced that she just signed a deal with Netflix. On Sunday, everybody's going up to Cupertino for the Apple announcement on Monday for their streaming services that are going to debut later this year. Steven Spielberg's already involved. Oprah Winfrey's already involved. Damien Chazelle. There's just so many avenues now. The question is, how many is too many?
And finally, we'll also find out exactly what will happen to the employees of Fox and Disney as the two great giants merge. Mark Edelman, thank you very much indeed for joining me on Monocle 24 from our LA Bureau. That's all we have time for today's edition of the Monocle Daily. Thank you to all our guests, and thanks to our producers, Augustin Macellari, Ben Rylan and Carlotta Ribello too. Researchers were Daphne Carnesis and Teresa Marvulli, and thanks to our studio manager, David Stevens. The Globalist is here in 8 hours time. Your host for that is Georgina Godwin, and the Monocle Daily returns at the same time tomorrow. But for now, from me, Emma Nelson, goodbye. Thank you very much for listening.